Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Ever want to tell a doctor if she just looked at this or asked that question, she might be able to get a better analysis of what might be wrong with you? Well, that's how it is for defense contractors, subject to checkups by the Defense Contract Audit Agency. The agency is beset by backlogs and other problems, and industry has ideas that might help. Joining me with more, Alan Chivotkin, Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council. And Alan, I guess at a hearing last week, some of the people from industry, including your group, were a little bit on their hind legs about the DCAA.
We were, Tom, and good morning. The answer is yes, defense contract auditing is an essential element of the overall success of the acquisitions in the Department of Defense and, in fact, across the federal government. While the Defense Contract Audit Agency is unique in its role within the Department of Defense, other agencies do a lot of contract auditing as well. What the purpose of the hearing from the Armed Services Committee was to explore the current backlog that exists within the Department of Defense for contractors, both in their business systems reviews and in incurred cost audits. These are the annual submissions that companies make of the cost they incur in the performance of contracts. And DCAA's own report to Congress showed that they are almost 2 years behind in being current in that auditing process. So the Congress Committee and the Armed Services Committee wanted to know more about that, not only to hear directly from DCA, but hear from industry, including the Professional Services Council, about what could be done about it.
Well, if they are 2 years behind on their auditing of contractor costs, how is that a contractor's problem?
Well, it's a contractor's problem in several respects. First of all, typically there is money at risk, money being held pending the conclusion of the audit. And when I say 2 years behind, it means it takes DCAA 2 years to do the audit. In many of the defense contractors, the last year that we have, many of those companies have closed audits, that is, all the agreements behind them from the audit, could be 4, 5, and 6 calendar years ago. So in many cases, it's 2010 or 2011. It's the last year that they have closed audits. So it takes DCAA about 2 years from the submission to finalizing that work. So contractors have money at risk. There is records that have to be retained for that period of time, in many cases well past performance. Third, there is a risk that money that is due them isn't readily available. You know, the closer you are to your contract closeout, the greater the likelihood is the current funds are available. The farther you get, the greater the likelihood that those funds are not current, and then the department has to rob from somebody else in order to make those payments. So from a company standpoint, it's a real concern. It's also a concern on the government side. Contracting program offices may not know how much money they have in their program, what the status is of those spending dollars pending the results of the audit. In addition, there are issues about the funding that I talked about on the contractor side also exist on the government side.
Sure. So do you get the sense that the DCAA itself is concerned with this?
Oh, very much so. And it's not a surprise. And to their credit, they've taken on some initiatives to try to shrink that backlog. In some respects, it's a resource question. They've had staff leave. They've under the hiring freeze right now, and some other changes, the policy changes that have taken place. So they're very conscious of it. They share the concern about it. They believe that more resources on their part, more people, more money would help solve it. Our recommendation from the Professional Services Council was to get temporary help, to use the third-party contractors, independent auditors, private auditing firms to help support some or all of their work to help close the background or as a permanent solution. And we've seen that used in the civilian agencies, NASA, the Department of Energy, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, other agencies in the civilian agency side have used the third-party auditing extensively. And we believe it's a model that can work in the Defense Department as well.
We're speaking with Alan Chivotkin, Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council. And what type of person, what type of skills are needed to be able to audit a contractor's costs?
Well, there are unique government contracting and auditing rules, and so you need somebody who has both individuals and companies that have experience working in the government arena. Your run-of-the-mill personal CPA may not be the most qualified. And in fact, we've raised questions about qualification when federal agencies have sought to use some independent CPA firms or independent accounting firms that don't have experience in the government marketplace. But there are lots of companies that have that government contracting experience that can be drawn on. And many of the individuals who are used in those that work are former government auditors themselves. So they have a great deal of familiarity with the rules and the processes.
And if you've been auditing contracts for energy or NASA or other civilian agencies, can you also swing over and do contracts on the defense side?
Very much so, except for some security clearance issues or others. Cost or cost, the regulations that exist today, both in the cost accounting standards and in many of the allowable cost areas, are identical between the defense and civilian agencies. So there is not a lot of differences in the work for civilian agencies and the Defense Department.
So the process is very similar, but the ratios might be different.
Certainly. And obviously the size of contracts, which is going to restrict the number of companies that are able to do that work. And it may very well be that for some of the largest DOD systems, you're best off using the resources that DCAA has and offload some of the other work. Some of the smaller activities to third parties. We said in our testimony that this does not have to be an all or never circumstance, and there may be flexibility that DCAA ought to be able to take advantage of.
In the experience of your members, when DCAA does complete an audit, do you find that the work is generally accurate and true?
Yes. We don't have any concerns about quality. We don't have any concerns about accuracy. The concerns are how long it takes and the volume of work. And, of course, it builds every year because every year that goes past, an additional set of over 6,000 incurred cost audit submissions are made by companies, and all of those then add to the queue. So a little bit of extra resources in and of itself is not going to do much to close off that backlog.
And do you suppose that given the backlog and how many contracts there are there, the sheer number of them and the length that it takes them to get through the process, could that be an opportunity for bad contractors to hide fraudulent costs or inflated costs?
Well, there's certainly a risk of that. Again, I think the well-trained auditors, whether they be government or contractors, can certainly find that. But if there is fraud, that's an issue that the government ought to pursue. Directly, we see referrals from the private sector back to government inspectors general all the time, and they do the investigations, and if they have to call an expert forensics advice, they do so. Again, often that advice is coming from government officials, but many times it's also coming from the independent third-party auditors.
Alan Chavatkin is Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Read more about the hearing and find a link to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
A violent gang member is the newest addition to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. And up to $100,000 reward is available for information leading directly to the arrest of Walter Giovanni Gomez. Leadership from the MS-13 gang in Plainfield, New Jersey, ordered Gomez to kill his friend for associating with a rival gang. Gomez and another gang member attacked his friend after a night of drinking in May of 2011. Case agent Daniel Bruner.
They hit him on the head with a baseball bat, sliced his throat, and stabbed him on his back 17 times.
When police tried to arrest Gomez,
he jumped out the second floor window of his home and escaped into the city of Plainfield.
The next day, gang members drove Gomez from New Jersey to Maryland to hide out with MS-13 members there. Gomez, also known as Cholo, is a native of Honduras. Report tips to 1-800-CALL-FBI or contact your nearest American embassy or consulate. With Wanted by the FBI, I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau.
Like Federal News Radio on Facebook for a look at some of the top federal stories each day. Plus, we'll give you a taste of what goes on behind the scenes. Find us at facebook.com/Federal News Radio.
The dream of creating a fully immersive and convincing virtual reality may still be in the future, but engineers at Oculus say we're getting closer. Technology advances like high-resolution displays and motion sensors small enough to fit in our smartphones are already giving us windows into virtual spaces. But Michael Abrash, chief scientist at Oculus, says use of all your senses is still limited.
Now imagine that you're not looking at it through a little window, you're not talking to it through a little handpiece. You're actually in it, able to interact with it with all these capabilities that have been evolved for humanity over many, many millions of years.
So Abrash says they're also working on things like how to use your hands naturally in a virtual world. No pointing and clicking. Possibilities for VR include training surgeons, educational experiences, and long-distance interactions, but
there are going to be the things that we never thought of that are actually the reason that this is transformational.
With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Technology inspires innovation. Innovation is a requirement for any business or agency. Listen Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 1 for Federal Tech Talk hosted by John Gilroy. John gives you the latest on products that help breathe life into federal IT policy. Lively, entertaining, and totally informative, Federal Tech Talk airs Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download at any time at federalnewsradio.com. Search Federal Tech Talk.
FederalNewsRadio.com. It's the only place to read Mike Causey. Get the latest news on your federal pay, benefits, and retirement at FederalNewsRadio.com. Search Causey.
Profile America, Monday, April 17th. For urban dwellers, the difficulty, or at least the expense, of doing their laundry began to ease this month in 1934. That's when the first public self-operated laundry in the U.S. opened its doors in Fort Worth, Texas. The first name was Washateria, eventually replaced with the now familiar laundromat. Early facilities were not necessarily coin-operated, and there was always an attendant on duty. The automatic washing machine came along in 1937, and by the late 1940s, the first unattended 24-hour laundromats were opened. Now, there are just under 11,000 dry cleaners and coin-operated laundromats across the country. Employing over 39,000 people, they do $3.5 billion of grime-fighting business annually. You can find more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The military universities include cybersecurity programs. Now one academic is asking, why doesn't the government just create a standalone cyber academy of its own? Mark Hagerot makes that proposal in a recent foreign policy article. Hagerot, chancellor of the North Dakota University System, tells Federal News Radio's Eric White why he thinks the time is ripe.
We are at a period of just profound change. And, having been a long-serving military officer and then professor, in an advanced technology field in cyber, I just realized as I was observing the lagging ability of our government to create the workforce that we needed to get some more solutions on the table. And that'd be the first distinction I make is, RSA and other leading companies, if they find a new, algorithm, a new cryptography program, they can mass produce this and send it around the world, through the internet and in a matter of probably days. But it comes to people, it takes years of education, inculcating values, norms, et cetera. And we are woefully behind, as your own publication has published articles on, in the race to create human talent to meet the cyberspace challenge we're facing. So So this is one more solution that I'm surprised hasn't been adopted yet, because I'd like to say, first off, that Homeland Security, NSA, Trump is doing enormous work in this field, the National Initiative for Cyber Education, NICE. They have all sorts of programs, incentives, credentialing. My own state here in North Dakota, we are working to apply for some of those credentials and will continue to do so. But it really surprised me that one of the things that was missing was a dedicated academy for undergraduates in this field. So that was the genesis of the article.
So pretty much every branch of the military now is stressing having their own cyber program, and you know the Naval Academy is going to build their own cyber facility. Why wouldn't it just be sufficient to have a sector of each branch covering this area?
Well, it's a great question, and I thought about it a lot, as my co-author has. They are doing wonderful work. I'm an Annapolis grad. I actually spent a half year at West Point. I served with the Army in Afghanistan. So these are such wonderful institutions and just selfless organizations in a tough time. But there's a couple reasons why they can't do it alone, and they should keep doing what they're doing. But the first one is they are traditional, industrial age academies created with the last meta revolution, if you want to call it that, which was industrialization in warfare and in our economy. And so they have divided responsibilities. They must protect us in the physical domain at sea, on land, and in the air. And they must do that because, as we were talking before the show, there's going to be the whole emergence of robotic warfare, that they have a huge challenge of how to modify their physical forces to defend against that. So the existing academies have a split responsibility of physically manning those areas. A second problem with the existing academies is they must have strict physical requirements. I was the chair of the admissions board at Annapolis, and I tell you, I think probably close to 80%, if not more, of all the admitted students were former varsity athletes, almost as close to physical perfection as you can get. But that leaves behind so many people, but for a rational reason. You've got to be able to carry a pack across, broken country in Afghanistan or fly a jet fighter and take umpteen Gs of force. So the traditional academies must balance that. The other thing I'd say, and I'm a former faculty member, and I'm actually got joint appointments here in both history, philosophy, and religion, and engineering, but the faculty at these academies, are of a traditional background, and in the case of Annapolis and some of the war colleges, they have the benefit of tenure, which means the existing structure, the faculty, can be there for another 30, 35 years, and we are in a period of rapid transformation. So how do you bring in the Silicon Valley people, the NSA people, the people that don't have those PhDs yet? Well, under an existing structure like this, you've got to go through the tenure hiring process and 7 years to tenure. And I know at Annapolis they're trying to adapt this as quickly as they can, but then you've got accreditation problems. So the existing academies are doing great work, but they have divided responsibilities in the physical sphere. They have requirements of physical entry, which I understand, and their faculty are established over 100 years, whereas a new academy from ground up, you build it the way you need it, you can bypass all those limits and get to what you've got to do much faster.
We're speaking with Mark Haggerott. He's chancellor of the North Dakota University System. So you were speaking about some of the applicants that you got at the Naval Academy. I imagine that maybe having a cyber university would help fill the cyber workspace, since a lot of academy recruits, whether it's West Point or the Naval Academy, you said that they're top of the line for their physicality. They, you don't want to waste that physicality by putting them behind a desk the rest of their career.
Well, correct. I served in Afghanistan in an education role, and I was just, honored to see these guys come off the helicopters doing the operations, and the physical demands on them. And so we need those people who are brilliant academically but also physical. But think of all the young people that may be, in a wheelchair. Or even think about our veterans who came back, our enlisted veterans who came back who want to serve and they can't because they were disabled. Well, now a cyber academy can admit them. them. And as you saw in the article, we would, you know, actually, quite frankly, not make, you know, Division I sports a priority, which are a tradition now at the big academies. And so we could bring in people to serve their country in ways the other academies can't without a radical transformation. And they may, actually. I mean, the academies may eventually radically transform admissions where they take 20% of disabilities. I mean, this may happen, but you can imagine how long that'll take, going through the foundations and the stakeholders and everything else to get there. And we are in a crisis. I mean, I've been on this topic for years, and until this election, I had people saying, it's no big deal. In fact, it was interesting. I was at one conference, and a business executive was asked, well, this is great. This digital technology you have is related to robotics and networks. What are the long-term life cycle costs of this? And he didn't mention cyber costs. And so we pressed him, what were the long-term cyber costs? And this executive of a major company said, well, when the cyber problem is solved, this will drop off. It is never going to be solved. Okay, this is the world we are in. Until the day my great-great-grandchildren die, we are going to be fighting in cyberspace and the digital networks, and we need to make long-term investments like an academy. It's not going to go away. Okay, that's probably where we're coming from.
So you get the attention of all the needed lawmakers and all the needed representatives. They say, all right, Mark, set up the cyber academy. What do you envision the structure of this would look like?
Well, first off, it has to have a hybrid presence. It needs to be physically in a place so you can build culture. I don't know if you've seen some of the recent literature coming out on business valuations. A recent book called The Wealth of Humans by Ryan Avant, just an article in Business Periodical, estimated that the value of many companies, 80% of it is our people, culture, and process. Well, that's bringing people together and developing a culture and then educating them in processes. And that requires a physical presence. So I see this as a physical place, but also, unlike some of the academies, big distance education where the world's experts, you know, can pipe in, you know, and, you know, I mean, shoot, maybe the CEO of Microsoft can teach a course on, you know, the grand strategy of cyberspace to these young officers, candidates, GS candidates. So both physical, so you build culture, connections, and people, and then also hybrid, where distance courses and probably very generous with, I would think, internships, that it would be built in, you know, a huge percentage of these would be internships, much like currently the Navy or the Army do summer cruises in combat units. Well, the cruises would be Wall Street, the utility industry, go back to your home state and work in the National Guard to build those connections to, you know, the huge infrastructure that's going to be the battleground of the future. The stakes are incredibly high. And again, going back to the World War I anniversary, you know, our great grandfathers failed to adapt to the reality of what war had become, and it had profound consequences for people who never thought war was interested in them, right? Before, war was behind the front lines, and now cities are being bombed, countries are being starved, and the failure to understand the magnitude of the technological change led to literally the collapse of civil societies from Russia, Turkey, Austria. Germany barely hung in there, but you know their king was gone. So the consequences are much, much broader and beyond of the services. So I would just encourage your readers that they should be engaged because we got to get this right fairly soon. And Cyber Academy could be one of those missing pieces we haven't adopted yet to complement, again, the great efforts being done by NSA and Homeland Security on their many other, you know, kind of boot camps, certificates, and, you know, grant money. But we don't have an academy devoted to this yet, and I think it's time for that.
Mark Haggerott is Chancellor of the North Dakota University System, speaking with Federal News Radio's Eric White. Find this interview posted at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.